Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Keith's panel, Russ Chianelli, and a guest today from Chicago. His name is Enrique Trevino. He's at the Lake Forest College up there, and he's a mathematician. And so this is going to be really interesting because I don't find it interesting to talk to not interesting. I don't find it facile to talk to mathematicians about mathematics because I'm not very skilled in that area. So we'll try anyway. So, Enrique, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us, before we get into your career, what your particular focus in mathematics is, tell us a little bit, how come you become a mathematician? Why are you a scientist? Where did it all begin?
When I was, 10 or 11 in my school, they taught us programming, and I really enjoyed creating little programs. And a lot of the times I had to solve math problems that were like outside of school to sometimes figure out how to code these things. So, for example, I wanted to write a program that if I gave it a date, it would tell me what day of the week it was. And one of the things I had to figure out was, well, the days cycle every 7. And I had to figure out, well, how do I tell a computer that they cycle every 7? So I kind of came up with a concept called modular arithmetic before I was taught it. And then
when you were 10?
No. This, when I wrote that program, I think it was in 6th grade. Maybe I was in 7th. So 12 or 13. So this school was is in Juarez. It's called Juan de Dios Pesa. And it was a private school, and they had a great computer science teacher.
Okay.
So they taught us to program in 5th grade.
So the point is then, regardless of the expertise and the capacity to do it, you had this little thing in your head that was interested in numbers and predicting numbers in a sense. When is it going to be a Thursday or whatever? So this was something that was, you didn't want to go out and look at snails, or you didn't want to kick rocks or do experiments. Numbers were what you were intrigued by.
Definitely numbers. I mean, all the time I would like to calculate things in my head. But, I mean, when I was programming, I had to solve, like, sort of new problems. Obviously, they're not new to the math community, but they were new to me. So this, I had to figure out this thing called modular arithmetic. And then a friend of mine told me, hey, why don't you create a game like Simon Says, but with numbers? And I mean, obviously, there's techniques that computer scientists use where they don't have to figure the math behind it, but I had to come up with my own solution. So one thing I wanted to do is, so if you type a number, the computer can tell if you type that one digit, but if you type 2, how does that computer know that that's a new number? That it's like, so like if you write 1 and 2, and we read that, we read 12, but how does the computer know?
It's 12 and not 1, 2, 3, etc.
Yes.
Right.
So I sort of got a better understanding of what our writing system is for numbers. You know, like 1, 2 means 1 times 10 plus 2, or 1, 2, 3 is 1 times 100 plus 2 times 10 plus 3. So like that was like a big light bulb. Like, oh, the numbers have this.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's a light bulb to me just thinking about it, because it's not something I've ever thought about. How does somebody recognize that 1, 2 is 12 as opposed to 1, 2 and part of another sequence?
Yeah, so like computer programming was a big influence in my thought, like because the computers are...
Well, what happened to Simon Says?
What happened? I was able to write that program. Yeah, it was fun. And then when I was in high school, I was invited to go to these special classes for people that might compete in math competitions. And by that time, what I wanted to be was a computer programmer because I loved computers. And when I went to these classes, I saw sort of like a creative side of math that's really not seen in school. Like, so there's this problem where you have the numbers 2, 5, 8. You have this sequence, you add 3. So 2, 5, 8, 11, 14. And then the instructor asked, does this contain any squares? And you know, it's a third of the numbers. There's infinitely many squares, I thought, of course. And then the answer is no, it doesn't contain any squares. And then they told us how you would show it, that it doesn't have any squares. And the proof is relatively simple. You just look at the remainder when you divide by 3. So when you have something with remainder 1 and you square it, it'll still have remainder 1. When you have something with remainder 0 and you square it, it still has remainder 0. When you have something with remainder 2 and you square it, well, 2 squared is 4.
So it's a square already.
So 4 has remainder 1. So there's, you never hit remainder 2. So when I saw that, I was like, wow, this is amazing.
We should repeat that so the audience can write it down. But we won't. We'll come back to it. But the point is that there is both here a fundamental aspect of mathematics and an enjoyment of a puzzle.
Yes. Right? Yeah, I think it was the puzzle aspect. So I was very involved with these competitions. So that problem, the instructor that taught me this was David Cosillo. And he was a lecturer here at UTEP for many years. In fact, when I was a student here, he was a lecturer. So he was a big influence in me wanting to be a mathematician.
Where did you do the competitions? Was this within the U.S. and Mexico?
It was in Mexico. Okay. So I was competing when I was a junior in high school, and I was in the top 6 for the state of Chihuahua, and the top 6 get to go to the Mexican Math Olympiad. And this was in 2000 in Morelia, and I was 23rd out of 180, and the first 16 are gold medalists, and then the next 32 are silver medalists. So I was a silver medalist.
Good.
I was very sad because that meant I couldn't go to the international competitions. Then the next year as a senior, I was able to be in the top 16 to be a gold medalist. But then those 16 train for 6 months, and then the best 6 get to go to the International Math Olympiad. And I was 10th, so I didn't make that team.
Okay.
Yeah. So you were crossing the border back and forth in, when you were in kindergarten.
That's correct, yeah. And also when I was in college, I still lived in Juarez when I was in college, and I crossed the border every day to come to UTEP.
So you came to UTEP and you got a degree in mathematics.
That's right.
All right. Yeah. And did you continue to do original work as an undergraduate student in mathematics? I mean, sort of a research project or a project of any description?
I did a research program at, so there's these things that the National Science Foundation funds called REU, which stands for Research Experience for Undergraduates. And I did one at Trinity University in San Antonio in 2005. And yeah, I guess that was my first, it was my first to-be-published paper. It was actually
what was
published.
It,
it was about a concept called Frobenius numbers. He was a German mathematician of the 19th century. Sometimes these numbers are called Frobenius Sylvester. Sylvester was an American mathematician. So actually, sometimes the theorem that's, the official name is Sylvester Frobenius, sometimes in the problem-solving community is called the Chicken McNugget Theorem. So it connects to, like, the McNuggets sold in McDonald's. So, you know, back in the day, you could buy either 4 pieces or 9 pieces. So then the question is, for what numbers could you buy boxes to, like, suppose you want 12 McNuggets. Could you do it? Well, you could buy 3 boxes of 4, so you can. But suppose you want 11. Well, you cannot do 11 because 9 plus 4 is 13. So the Chicken McNugget Theorem tells you what number from that point forward you can do everything and what's the last number that you cannot do. So for 4 and 9, I think it's, so the formula is something like 4 times 9 minus 4 minus 9. So is that 23? So I think 23 you can't do. No, you can do 23 you can, and every number afterwards, but not 22.
Your parents must have had a tough time with you. I mean, I'm just trying to think now. Everything is based upon numbers. I have a particular game in my family, trying to make a number that I see come out to equal in some way 88, okay? Or if it's not big enough, 8, all right? But and it's amazing. Once you get into this habit of looking at a number and manipulating it, you can come up with the number 88, all right? I mean, it's not important, but the point is it's just makes time go by when you're on the road, for example. Okay. So your parents, did they find this a absurdly interesting, or just, oh, this is Enrique, right? What an interesting mind he has.
Or did they send you to a psychiatrist?
Well, my mom, when she started, she also graduated from UTEP. She started out as a math major. And my dad is a dentist, but he wanted to be an engineer. He chose to be a dentist so he wouldn't have a boss. And now he loves it, of course. I think they're both inclined to like numbers also.
And you have brothers and sisters? Or
yeah, I have a sister, and she's also very good at math. She's now doing a master's in finance, I think.
Oh, well, that's she can look after you in your old age.
Right? Yeah. Your parents are still in Juarez?
Yes, both my parents are in Juarez.
So let's move on a little bit then to, you went to university here. You went to graduate school where?
At Dartmouth.
At Dartmouth, yeah. Okay. That's one of the Ivy League schools up there in cold New Hampshire, is it?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so tell me about that experience when you got there. This must have been quite a distinction from being your childhood, in fact, in your formative years. What did you think of being at an Ivy League school?
Well, I was very excited. I liked it a lot. I mean, so Dartmouth is not that well-renowned in math.
Okay.
So I had other offers that other people thought I should take because they're more well-renowned in math. But I liked that Dartmouth had like a smaller department of students, so I thought I would make friends easily, which turned out to be right. And I really wanted to work with Carl Pomerantz, who ended up being my advisor. So when I was looking at grad schools, when I went to visit them, I mainly used it to like interview who I might work with. And I really like him as a person, and I really like his mathematics. So when I was an undergrad, my uncle gave, because he knew I liked math, he gave me this book called The Man Who Loved Only Numbers. Something like that, maybe. Maybe not only numbers.
I think that's a correct title, by the way.
Yeah?
The Man Who Loved Only Numbers.
So it's a biography of Paul Erdős, who was a very eccentric mathematician who would travel the world and would like arrive at a university, work for 3 weeks with somebody, then move on to another place, and then another place. And I just love the story, but at the same time, one of the characters in that story is Carl Pomerantz, who was one of his co-authors. So my advisor worked a lot with Erdős. They have 20-something, a couple of dozen papers together. So the type of mathematics I do now is very influenced by the mathematics that Erdős did.
Okay, so the uncle's book taught you the name, or not taught you, but exposed you to the name, and then, wow, there's that possibility.
Yeah, I remember walking in Bell Hall here at UTEP and seeing a poster for a conference. It's called CNTA, is pretty much one of the biggest conferences in my area, number theory. And the plenary speaker was called Pomerantz, and it says Dartmouth. And I'm like, oh, maybe I should apply there. Like, I didn't consider applying there before seeing that poster.
Okay. You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Enrique Trevino from Lake Forest College in Chicago area. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Enrique Trevino from Lake Forest College, Chicago, mathematician. And you just told us a really fascinating story about how you developed. All right. And after then getting your PhD, tell us how does a student get a PhD in mathematics? It's different from the other scientists that we've spoken to on this program.
Could you be more specific?
Well, I know that in chemistry or in physics, you work with a mentor, and the mentor is sort of constantly guiding you. And at some stage, you'll write some papers with a mentor, and then you'll write an individual thesis. But in mathematics, it's a little different in the sense, as I understand it, and I may be wrong, that you get a mentor that simply says, hey, Enrique, here's a very interesting problem. Why don't you go away and look into it? And then you're on your own. I mean, you can go back and get help from time to time, but the fruition out of that study is your own paper. You know, the mentor is no longer associated with it. This is very different. It's much nobler, I would think, than the way we do it, where we have graduate students and our name is on every paper of all the work they do.
I see. Yes, it's, I mean, at least in my area, it's more common that the papers you write as a graduate student only have your name, unless you work with another graduate student. But of course, there's variety in the math community. In some areas of math, it is more common to write with the advisor. For example, I think in applied math, that's the common practice. But yes, with my advisor, as a grad student, I ended up writing 5 papers, and all of them, well, 4 of them have my name, and another one is me and an undergraduate at Dartmouth.
So your advisor, did he publish during this time? He was working on his own particular issues and papers?
Yes, he was leading other PhD students.
Yeah, but they're all writing independent papers.
They're writing independent.
What I'm trying to get here. If you're a professor, what is your paper count and how did you get it?
Yeah, he would write with other collaborators that already are PhDs usually. I do have one paper with him, but this wasn't like part of the thesis. He had a project with another person and they thought I could help with one part of the paper, and then I got into the
paper. So what was the title of your thesis?
The title of my thesis is Numerically Explicit Estimates for Character Sums.
You asked the question, you got the answer, Russell.
Yeah. Yeah, that was in 2011.
Right. Well, this is all very interesting. And for most people, I think, the idea of the games that you can play with the math, this business that I have of trying to find 88s, I mean, it's trivial, but the point is it's sort of fun. Keeps your mind going. And we were talking when we were having breakfast about this other little game about doing a tossing of a coin and how many times do you have to toss it before you've got the equal number of heads and tails, right?
Yes.
Just summarize again what the principle is there.
So the principle is you flip a coin, and then you keep flipping until the number of heads you've recorded is the same as the number of tails. So for example...
So if I flip it twice and I get a heads and a tail, the answer is 2.
Yes.
All right. And what's the sort of the generalized average, do you think, in the world?
In the world?
No, if you, I, mean,
I,
if you keep
I don't
doing
know about
it.
The empirical...
You don't
answer,
know.
But I do know that mathematically, theoretically, the average would be infinity.
So there we
so
are.
That's
well,
a
we're
going to
try a little mathematical experiment. We haven't got to call it. I'll just... So that's a tails.
Okay. That's a head.
That's a head. So we did
2.
It beautifully. So we did it in the minimum amount of effort.
Yes.
We didn't need an infinite number of tosses. Right.
All right, well, how about this one then? Why don't you talk about, because what's always interested me, and I think I have the book on my shelf, The Guide Without Numbers or whatever that is, and let's talk a little bit about the history of mathematics going back to the Greeks.
Okay.
And talk about one thing that's always intrigued me has been prime numbers. Can you tell us what a prime number is?
Yes, a prime number is... number that's only divisible by itself in 1. And I mean, actually, my field, number theory, studies primes. So I'm a huge fan, of course.
And who discovered prime numbers? Doesn't that go back to ancient Greece or something?
I don't think anyone gets credit for discovering them. Of course, the first big theorem about prime numbers was written by Euclid in The Elements, which I guess the book is more famous for geometry, but it has, so it's like 13 books and at least 2 of them are about number theory. So he gave a proof that there's infinitely many prime numbers. And so like every undergrad math major has to see this proof probably by sophomore year. Like it's a classic proof is usually used to teach students how to prove by contradiction.
What is proof by contradiction?
So the idea is that you assume that something is false, and then you get to something absurd. So that means that what you assumed was false had to be true. So in this case,
uh-huh.
You would assume that it's false that there's infinitely many prime numbers. So if it's false, it means that there are finitely many. So now the proof goes, okay, grab this finitely many, multiply them all together, add one. This new number is not divisible by any of those primes, so it must be divisible by another prime. So that's a contradiction because you had all the primes.
So there's must an infinite number of prime numbers.
Yes.
And there's an infinite number of just plain numbers.
Yes.
So there's two different infinities there. That's an interesting kind of question.
Yes.
That actually is, Russell, a very interesting
Two
concept.
Different infinities.
Well, in set theory, they're actually considered the same size, those infinities. There is an infinity that's larger, and that's the set of real numbers.
I thought I remembered somewhere that there was a program that they were calculating the next prime number, and they were way out there.
Yes, so there's this, it's called GIMPS.
GIMP.
The Great Internet Mersenne Prime Search. And anyone can download it in their computer. It'll just work when the computer is idle. And it tries to find bigger and bigger primes. So,
now, is that a game, or does that have some utility in the world of of mankind?
In the universe.
Well, depends on how you define utility. But, I mean, I think sometimes it's used to check, like, chips of computers, because some things have been calculated so many times and that are hard to calculate. Then you can check if a computer is well-tuned by comparing things. But, I mean, that utility is obviously indirect. I think it's more of a, you know, a quest to find bigger and bigger things. There used to be a prize for whoever would find the first prime with at least 10 million digits would get $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that was found this decade, for example.
So what's the limit now? Who's got the biggest one?
Well, the last, like, 10 biggest ones have all been found by this
machine,
you know, like, worldwide. Because the GIMPS, you could download it on your computer. So it's like a worldwide search. And the last 10 have been found by this, you know, by all of us, I guess.
Which is still showing about the interconnectivity of our computers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite scary, as a matter of fact.
It has about 34 million digits, the last one that has been found. But obviously, there's bigger ones because there's infinitely many.
So you just pick a number, add one, and then try to divide it or something like that.
Yeah, of course, if you try that, it'll take forever to beat the current record. So what they do, and also checking if something's prime is really hard. In fact, that's one of the reasons why they use this for, like, encrypting. It's very easy to multiply things, but very hard to divide them, well, to factor them. So there's special types of numbers that are easier to check if they're prime. So these are numbers that are one less than a power of two. So if you're one smaller than the power of two, is a little easier to check if you're prime. So these GIMPs, they always search primes that are of that form. And so if you look at the record of the biggest primes, it's always, I mean, always, since like the 1700s, the record is held by one of those.
Okay. Let's just, we've got a few minutes left. I'm not quite sure where
what's the future
how to handle.
What's the big questions in mathematics?
Well, before we get to that, we'll give that the last 10 seconds, right? But the whole idea of your interests, some of it is purely, I won't say entertainment, entertaining, it's a game. But
yeah.
Then there's some other aspects of what you do that are fundamentally very utilitarian and important, right?
Well, I mean, so I have like two main research directions. One is analytic number theory. And the other one is a field called recreational mathematics. Now, I do both because of recreational purposes. Number theory technically has utilitarian approaches, the one I was describing about the fact that factoring is hard. So that is a number theory problem. And my main like driving force was mainly because I just like the problems. I'm a purist, so I don't think as much about the utilitarian approaches.
Well, I mean, that's the same in many areas of science. I mean, Russell is very much a utilitarian sort of a fellow. He likes to make things and make materials and study them that have some benefit for mankind in his head, whether they do or not. That's a separate issue. I, on the other hand, just for the pure enjoyment and creativity of putting elements together to see what would their properties be without hoping for any utilitarianism? You've got a mixture of the two. So you've combined Russell and myself quite nicely in mathematics. It's very entertaining.
Well, I've learned that the mathematics is extremely interesting and difficult. So I congratulate you on your progress.
Thank you.
I concur with that completely. And Sam, I'm sure Sam will put this together. It's going to be sounding very interesting. It's been fascinating to be here, Enrique, and just sort of delve into the way you think. And it's impressive. So thank you very much for being here. Thanks, Sam, again, for putting the program together. Thank you for Russell for maintaining dignity and interesting integral questions. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Hasta la vista. And don't forget, we did this trick in two tosses. That's impressive. All right, I'll do it one more time. That's a heads.